right thing and could not succeed in this institution that is built on doing the right thing without fear or favor.
We've been speaking with Carol Lenig and Aaron C. Davis, both Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporters. Their new book is out today. It's Injustice: How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. That does it for our show. I'll be in St. Louis on Friday, speaking in the Q&A after the film Steal This Story, Please, plays in two theaters in St. Louis. Check our website at democracynow.org. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
This is Aubriana Bench with WRCT Pittsburgh. This is the show Forbes Avenue. Today I'm joined by Colin Mockery and Asad Meki. You guys may know Colin from his experience as an improv comedian on Whose Line Is It Anyways? Colin, I actually watched this show growing up all the time with my brothers.
I'm sure since you were a fetus, you heard it from the walls of the womb.
Yeah, it was I loved it so much. I got to say, you were my favorite. Don't tell Ryan or Wayne. Anyways. And then we have Asad Meki, a world-renowned hypnotist who's performed for millions. And you guys have come together to create a show combining your expertise. So, I mean, I wanted to start with an easy question for you guys, which is, how are you guys? How do you feel about the upcoming tour?
It's good, and I think it's all places we haven't been before, so it's always nice to open up in virgin territory and show people exactly what this show is. So we're pretty excited. The show's a lot of fun, so we enjoy doing it, and we hope that that sort of excitement sort of carries on into the audience.
What other locations are you guys touring in other than Pittsburgh?
We're going to be going to Washington, D.C., all the way up to Fallsview, which is Niagara Falls in Canada. I mean, we've been doing the show pretty much nonstop for the last few years. We've done 200 cities across North America. We performed in Las Vegas and off-Broadway. So coming to Pittsburgh, looking forward to it.
Fantastic. I'm really interested how you two first met. Who approached who, and how did you work out the kinks of combining improv and hypnotism? I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but
I'll take that one, Colin. So I'm the master hypnotist on the show. I reached out to Colin through his website. His longtime manager, Jeff Andrews, got back in touch. In it, I outlined the concept of blending hypnosis and improv on stage together. And Jeff Andrews, my now partner and Colin's longtime manager, got back in touch and said, this looks like a really interesting idea. So we ended up throwing it up on the main stage of the Second City after the main stage show was completed, just kind of on a whim. And Colin was good enough to try it out with me. And let me tell you, the first show, for me, it was very nerve-wracking. because, and I don't really go into too much detail about it because, you know, a lot of these interviews are pretty short, but because we have got some time with you, I will tell you, I was so nervous because, you know, you're going up with an improv legend at the Second City, which is like a storied location and where all the greats have come out of as improvisers. And there's me pitching this idea. I'm not even sure if it's going to work. I don't know if I'm going to be embarrassed in front of the Second City crowd. And Colin was just like a consummate professional. He was just so calm and kind of reassuring and saying, you know what, let's give it a shot and see how it goes. But I will tell you, that first night was nerve-wracking for me.
Yeah, I've tried to find as many clips as I can online about what the show is all about, but what exactly goes down on stage, you know, how is it different from typical improv maybe, or what has stood out for you guys?
I'll take this question. So I'm the master hypnotist on the show. I bring up 20 volunteers. I hypnotize them, whittle it down to the best subjects, the most responsive subjects. And then Colin Mockery from Whose Line Is It Anyway improvises with the people on stage while they're hypnotized. So that is the main crux of the show. Colin comes out, improvises with these people. He's never met them before. We don't use plants, so we've not prearranged anything with anyone. They're just responding to the suggestions that I give to them. And Colin is creating an instant improv troupe with them. And absolute madness, chaos, hilarity ensues.
Have you found that people tend to be more willing to do stuff when they're under hypnosis?
So the part of the brain that deals with self-reflection becomes disconnected when somebody's hypnotized. So they no longer reflect on their behavior. They just carry out my suggestions without hesitation, without question. First-time improvisers, they'll play to the crowd. They'll look nervous. They'll hesitate. They'll use filler words. These people don't do that. They just jump in and they respond immediately to the suggestions that I give to them, and they're fully committed in the scenes. So it makes for really good improv.
Yeah. Colin, I know Whose Line always had super fast scenes for you. Has Hiprov changed your relationship with improv and like maybe made you slow down a bit or change how you work with doing improv?
Yes, in some ways it did, because, you know, when I'm working with the Whose Line guys or when I'm working with other improvisers around the world with different companies, because we have the same sort of foundation and we're all working towards making a scene together and, you know, working towards an ending, it is kind of more fast-paced and deliberate, or not deliberate, but with the people I'm working with, because I don't know them, I have to sort of actually slow down a bit and go sort of back to my early days in improv where, okay, I'm focusing on this person, I'm listening to what they're saying, because also I can't go in with any prejudgment like, oh, this is a perfect setup I've just given them, they're going to take it and go here. They don't do that. They have their own, they just live in the moment we're in right now. They're not looking, oh, if we do this, we can end up in a rocket ship and fly off into space, that'll be the end of the scene. They're just keep going. And it makes it fun for me because I don't, as I say, I can't have any expectations. So I'm truly in the moment with them, truly improvising, going along with whatever they've come up with.
Yeah, so it's just so much more unpredictable than normal.
Oh, absolutely. There are times I think, okay, now we're done, we're finished, and then they'll add something where you go, oh, why did you do that? Now that's all right. But yeah, and every night we're just taken by surprise by people, and that's, I think, what makes it really exciting for us.
Yeah.
It's really about, to Colin's point, it's about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. It's these people who have no acting background, no improv background. They come up on stage, they join Colin, and the superstar of the show, because every night we find one, is battling wits with Colin. It's incredible to watch. I'm even dumbfounded at times and just completely caught off guard throughout the show because they're giving such incredible, interesting offers, ideas, pushing the scene in different directions that you just wouldn't normally get. It's just, Colin often says words to the effect of, any trained improviser would never come up with that material. Any person who is trained in the art of improv would never have come up with it, because it's so off the wall and so odd and strange and out there.
So when you're hypnotizing these people, do you give them prompts that like prompts them to think along these lines, or does something happen that they're just like all of a sudden like proposing to Colin or like?
Yeah, so we get, so there are games, there's formats.
Okay.
Wherein we have structure. So for example, let's say an old time Western where they're on the run because of something. So when you watch our Instagram clips, there's not that much context. So yeah. What are the questions coming from? So there's definitely format to it and game setup, but what occurs inside is all completely improvised and we have no idea what they're going to say.
So it's kind of like set scene and then they run wild,
whatever. It's exactly like Who's Line in that way. All right, you're two people out in outer space, aliens are attacking, go. It's just that easy.
It'd be so funny if you have like in Who's Line where it was like the top down camera, you have them like wiggling on the floor trying to make it look like they're standing up straight.
We're bringing it in. We got to do it.
Yeah, let's get that going. Our budget is so big now.
That's for the multi-million dollar game show, Colin.
Jeez.
We're putting that in. Those were some of the funniest scenes. The ones where they're doing martial arts, hysterical.
What do you think? What is both of your guys' like favorite thing that has happened on stage? Like immediate standout.
I mean, it's so hard because every night there's something, and there's something that either takes us by surprise or something. Sometimes it takes place after the show. There was this man who we did an improvised song together, and he was like James Brown. He was like killing it. He was rhyming, making sense, and he sounded amazing. After the show, see him with his family. His entire family is crying. They've never seen him sing, never heard him sing. He's very kind of self-effacing and kind of small. It was just, to me, that just kind of hit home that what Assad does with these people, unlocking the talents that they have that for whatever reason they're keeping hidden.
I think back to a scene, because we've been doing it for so long, 2016 Second City. Colin's doing a tap dance with one of the volunteers, and it's completely improvised and hysterical. I think about that when I think about just things that surprise me and catches me off guard. And the crowd was going absolutely bonkers.
I was 10 years younger, so it was easier. Now I just tap with a cane.
That's still dancing. That's still
dancing. Yeah, I guess. I think it is, as long as you're moving to music.
That's amazing that you can just, like, tap into people's hidden talents. And, you know, like, 5 years from now, you'll see them. They're going to be, like, an incredible dancer because they had never known a muscle.
Well, it's interesting because we've had people who have done the show. This one lady, she had crippling social anxiety, came up, didn't know why she wanted to volunteer. She volunteers. She becomes a superstar of the show. She's battling wits with Colin on stage. We interview her afterwards. She says, I don't know why I came up. I have crippling social anxiety, but I wanted to give it a shot. And she said, she said she'd been more free than she'd ever been before and that she wanted to explore improv. So I think there is something to it in that you're getting rid of the part of the brain that's saying, you can't do this, you're going to look stupid, you're going to look silly. All that kind of stuff just kind of floats away and they're just free up there. And it's really beautiful to watch. When they're in the zone, it's when I see Colin and we call them hypnotizers, the people who volunteered on stage that are improvising while hypnotized. When they're in the zone, it's like, it's magical on stage. It truly is. it sounds cheesy, but it is beautiful because you're seeing somebody on stage who doesn't have improv background, no acting experience. They're in front of 1,000 people and they're completely free. It's childlike and beautiful to watch.
So, like, how do you know if someone is hypnotizable or not?
Yeah, so I start with 20 volunteers, and approximately 20% of the population are going to be good subjects, hypnotic subjects for a stage hypnosis show. So from there, I whittle it down to the best 4 or 5, and then Colin comes out and then improvises with them. And I'm basing it on physiological feedback. So I'm looking for changes in rate and location of respiration. So breathing changes, skin color changes, you go light to dark, dark to light, vasodilation, the capillaries in the eyes become engorged. Slow, sluggish movement, muted voice, mask-like facial expression. So they have a hypnotic mask. So they look like they have a poker face. So I'm looking for all of these physiological signs or indicators. And if I see them, then I'll keep the people on stage that are hypnotized. And then if I don't, then I'll just ask them to leave. And it's kind of like what poker players are looking for when they're trying to get a read, like an unconscious read on or a tell on their opponent. It's same kind of thing. So I'm watching all of them very closely and then determining who's going to be the best candidates.
How long does this take? Do you think I'd be hypnotizable over Zoom?
It takes about five to 10 minutes roughly. And it's very hard to determine until I'm in front of the person. And well, hypnosis is context driven too, because they've come up on stage, they've decided they want to be hypnotized. So a lot of the really good subjects, believe it or not, hypnotic subjects are already primed. So they already start to exhibit these trance indicators. So they start to look like their eyes start to defocus. They start to exhibit mask-like facial expression. They start to look kind of tranced out when they come up on stage. So they're already kind of primed. And if you pay attention, you can even notice when you talk to people, you can see when people start to go into trances because their eyes defocus. They start looking, they're not really looking at you. They're looking kind of through you and they look like they're not paying attention. That's kind of what I'm looking for when I'm looking for a good subject on stage, somebody who's not paying attention. So, I'm saying this obviously tongue in cheek, but you kind of get a sense of it, yeah. Right? Sort of tell when people start to look like they're in another place.
Interesting. Colin, have you ever been hypnotized by
People keep pushing us to do it. So Asad hypnotized me and it's incredibly relaxing. And part of the fun of this show, I'm going to say fun, I don't know if that's the right word, but we have these two art forms that people are always doubting. All through the Whose Line years, I would have people say, I saw you reading cue cards. I was like, really? Okay. Then transcribe that scene, read it back and see if it makes any sense whatsoever. And it's the same with hypnosis. People, for whatever reason, just have a high level of skepticism. And that's what's great about this show, especially for family members or people who know the subjects. They are certainly seeing that it truly is something that works. And I hope it dispels a lot of the sort of the myths about hypnotism. Everything you see on movies and television tend not to be truly connected to the world. These people aren't, they haven't lost who they are. They're still the same people. They're aware the entire time. They just don't have that part of the of their brain that says you can't do this. You're going to embarrass yourself. They just have complete freedom.
It's like people think someone's going to pull out a Queen of Hearts and something crazy is going to happen there.
We definitely are on the fun light side of the hypnosis, not on the clinical application. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say the people who are brought up are treated very safely. Asad is very careful with them, making sure that they're in a safe spot and that everything is good. When I'm improvising, I'm trying to make sure that as I would treat any improviser. So, you know, we're not making fun of them, making them cluck like chickens or bark like dogs or doing anything embarrassing, have them take off their clothes. They're just your basic improv troupe that we're having fun with.
The old version, because there's people who are listening to this and have seen the, you know, bark like a dog, cluck like a chicken hypnosis shows. That's not this show. For the crescendo of the show, I'll give you an example. Colin is a detective solving a case. He gets the information from the audience about what the case is about. He improvises the case completely on stage. And then one of the volunteers plays all the different characters that Colin comes into contact with while solving the case. So he might come into a contact with a femme fatale. He may come into contact with the chief of police, and they're changing and morphing into the different characters. So it's very much elevated. When we performed off Broadway, we were covered by the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time Out, New Yorker, and we were actually nominated by the Off-Broadway Alliance Awards for most unique theatrical experience. So it's very much theater.
Yeah, yeah. I read those articles, and I also found some like personal experiences that people were posting online and stuff. And it just really seemed like if someone wasn't uncomfortable, they were able to sit back down and eventually be guided out of the hypnotic state if they didn't want to be there. And
yeah, you get stuck in hypnosis. So that's one thing a lot of people talk about is, what would happen if, the hypnotist dropped dead, mid show, right? It was Dr. Orney that ran the experiments, and I believe it was Harvard. They hypnotized first year psychology students, turned off all the lights, left the lecture hall, 5 to 15 minutes, all of them would come out of the hypnosis. And that experiment's been replicated many times. You're not asleep when you're hypnotized, although the Greek god of sleep, fun fact, is named Hypnos, I should say. But you're not asleep when you're hypnotized. You're aware of what's going on. You're hearing the sound of my voice at all times. Physiologically, you look asleep. So because your body's really relaxed, but you are not asleep. So you're aware of what's happening at all times. You can't be made to do anything that you don't want to do when you're hypnotized. You can be made to do things that you normally wouldn't do. So that's the distinction for when it comes to stage hypnosis. And when people come up on stage, they have already given tacit permission. They are there to experience the hypnosis. And then they really do have these tremendous experiences. The best way to describe hypnosis would be watching a movie, getting so caught up in what you're watching that you're moved to a physiological response. So that would be the best way to describe a hypnotic trance state. So you watch a horror movie, you get caught up, your palms start to sweat, your heart starts to race. Logically, you know what you're watching on the big screen is not real, but for that moment in time, during that scary scene, you think it's really real. Or you watch a tearjerker and you start to cry. Logically, you know that, you know, the person who's on the big screen's not actually dying. It's not Leonardo DiCaprio going down with the ship. It's actually it's not Jack going down. It's Leonardo DiCaprio who's acting, and, you know, he's dating models in Hollywood, making millions of dollars, right? So he's doing just fine. But for that moment in time, you're really, really, really so dialed in that you get that emotional response. So because you're so fully immersed in the movie, and that's the best way to describe what occurs up on stage when somebody's hypnotized.
Because he could have fit on that door.
Could have easily. Just push her off. Get on.
Oh, yeah, or that. Like, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So kind of veering away, I'm curious if you guys have any tips for someone maybe wanting to get into improv, because this is a totally different show, maybe taking a different approach, or would you want them to start out, you know, just doing typical improv? Or
I say to first of all, if you're looking to do improv as a career, I always say, if there's anything else you love, do that instead. You know, it's great. We were, everyone on Whose Line, incredibly fortunate that this show came from Britain to showcase the one thing we do well. But I also say, take improv classes. It is a great life skill to have, to learn how to listen to people, to learn how not to prejudge situations. And if you decide to do it as a profession, just keep doing it. And so many people who have started doing that have branched off into coming up with different ways of doing improv. You know, like Asad coming up with this particular brand. I have a friend who he started Dungeons and Dragons improv shows, where the characters from Dungeons and Dragons, and there's a dungeon master who sort of guides them through an improv adventure. Then there's like one act plays that people have improvised based on a certain playwright like Shakespeare or Chekhov. So you can do so much with improv, not only on stage, but in life. So I always encourage people to do it. It's a great skill.
What is the industry like the performance industry or touring?
It's horrible. You know, there's a lot of people out there, incredibly talented people who, you know, either can't get a break. And there's a lot of talented people who are working right now, showing, you know, we're lucky we've come up with this sort of, you know, I don't think there's any other improv hypnosis shows out there. So good on us. You have to find your place in there, but it's a hard business. It's a hard business because, you know, you can't show your resume and go, here's what I can do. I can build a house in 3 days. It's like, here, I make up stuff. It's pretty hard to find a job that you know, fits. And, you know, you're based on your appearance a lot of the time. I know so many incredibly talented people who just haven't had that break yet. But, you know, when you're in this business, it's a business of dreams. And everything can change overnight. You can go from, you know, Wayne Brady was a Tigger at Disney World, and then he got Who's Line. I don't think he went back to Tigger. It's worked out nicely for him.
Yeah. Crazy. How do you both see hip-prov?
Oh, man. Well, yeah, Asad has viciously berated people for less than that.
How do you both see hip-prov moving forward in the future? Do you think you'll add changes or maybe add people?
So I will tell you that we just sold hip-prov to a major Canadian streamer in Canada. We've licensed the show there. We shot a special, and now Canadian viewers can watch the show. I think the next step is to have it streaming in the United States. So that would be the next step, and then global, because we'd love to bring hip-prov to the masses.
Yeah, but also it would be great if we could, you know, every country have a hip-prov with a local improviser, a local hypnotist, speaking in their own language, doing whatever they do, and while we rake in the money. That's my dream. Asad, he's very, you know, he's noble and he has better, you know, he wants to make mankind better. I just want to add an addition to my house.
Are you guys doing anything in addition to hip-prov right now? Or is that like your both main focus right now?
I have an album out with Rufus Wainwright. It's entitled An Exploration of Hypnotic Sound. It actually features John Hilson, who is an incredible musician who plays improvised music with us throughout the show. He's our musical director, incredible keyboardist. So definitely someone to watch as well. His name is, again, John Hilson. He's part of the album.
Yeah, I do stuff. There's a TV show called Murdoch Mysteries. I think I'm a semi-regular as a serial killer. So I think I may be coming back for a bit. And then, something always pops. I was out for my mother's 90th birthday in Vancouver, ended up doing a horror movie for a couple of days in the interior of BC, which was a lot of fun. That's spoiler alert, I didn't make it.
No.
Yeah.
So first you were a serial killer.
And then I got, yeah, I got my comeuppance in another project.
Yeah, and then you got serial killed.
That's, yeah. That's karma.
Is there anything else you guys want to say to our audience before we sign off? Sure.
So I think the show is fast-paced. Hip-hop is fast-paced. It's action-packed, high energy, and hilarious because we've got Colin Mockery from Whose Line Is It Anyway improvising with people he's never met before who are hypnotized.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it's family-friendly. You have to be 18 or over to be hypnotized, but we have kids come to the show. They really enjoy it. They love seeing adults be goofy.
So the kids can't be hypnotized?
We just asked for 18 and up.
Apparently there's laws. Oh, well. So my idea of like 12-year-old butlers is no longer relevant.
It's been super great chatting with you guys.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's been really great. All right. Well, this has been Aubrey on a Bench with Colin Mockery and Asad Meki. Thank you guys again so much.
Thank you.
But yeah, your show, Hip Roth, will be at Carnegie at Homestead, I believe?
I believe so.
On November 9th.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to let you guys know that everything that you're going to hear today is strictly the opinions of myself and my guests today, and don't necessarily represent the views of WRCT. We're back. We're actually doing new episodes. I promise this is a thing. We're making it happen. And we have a guest today. We're actually talking about something interesting, or a couple interesting things today. We have a longtime friend of mine hailing from Texas. We have Gavin here with us today. Welcome to The Angry Young Man.
Hello.
Yeah, so, I mean, I had a couple things that would be interesting for us to talk about. I know there was something you wanted to talk about, but I've been reading what some may call the book of the year so far. I'm reading Abundance by Ezra Klein.
I have a copy of that.
You have a copy of that? I just now got a copy because they had, ironically, Abundance was not abundant for a period of time. I just got a copy of it. It's interesting because, you know, if for those of you who have listened to the show before, you'll know that I have a little bit of a fixation with housing. But it's interesting to see, you know, this argument for abundance liberalism and talking about using state capacity to kind of pursue growth and look at these things. I've only gotten about 30 pages into it so far. There's some things that I agree with. There's some things I disagree with. But I guess we'll start off this segment by kind of getting at that. I mean, Gavin, would you consider yourself an abundance liberal?
I'm not. I don't know. I guess I agree with the idea. I don't know.
I mean,
how would you define abundance liberal? And we'll go from there.
Well, I find it kind of the defining factor that separates it, the abundance liberal from, say, you know, the free market absolutist or fundamentalist, is the idea that there's a necessity to use state capacity to go after both supply and demand. I mean, they look at it as, and they open in the book by saying that, you know, for so long, because the fundamental kind of crux of economics is supply and demand, how it's been divided in half, and each side of the political spectrum has kind of made one of those their baby, in the sense that the right has been entirely supply focused and the left has been entirely demand focused. And, you know, the lack of understanding that both have their own importance, because they are supply and demand, not just supply or just demand. They kind of advocate for the, you know, the pushing of both to go about things. I mean, I have my fair share of disagreements kind of going out the gate with some of the claims, specifically as they relate to using state capacity to push for a lot of these things or to subsidize demand. Or look for some of those things. They may be addressed later in the book. I haven't gotten just far into it just yet. But I mean, I'm curious. To what degree do you subscribe to those sorts of claims? And if so, what's your critique of say the market fundamentalist approach that I'm sure you know you're aware that I hold on this matter.
Yeah, I'd say. In all things, in housing, which is our first topic, in food and water, there we have, I guess, the title of the book, we already have a superabundance of all of these things. We have enough where if we had the perfect allocation of resources, a perfect system, nobody would ever starve. Because we have more food than anyone could eat. We have more housing. We have more homes than homeless people. All of these things. So we're at a point now where it's not really a matter of how do we grow food? How do we have more houses? How do we have enough for everyone to survive? Which is what most of human history was about. And we now are at a point of, okay, how do we think about our systems to have them structured in such a way that everyone... has enough. And I think that's kind of where we should be going forward as a society at this point. So especially in terms of housing, I don't think we should accept homeless people as a concept at all. And if that means somebody has like a homeless shelter, that's like a little studio apartment, then that's what that is. I think you should be given the bare minimum. And I think beyond that, if you want to work for something harder, absolutely. Like even, and this is where I'm going to lose people, but like even if you're like a drug addict and you want to be in your home all day doing drugs, I don't think you should have a particularly good quality of life. I don't think, because you're not contributing to society at all. But I don't think it's very ethical to say somebody should die. In that circumstance, just should be on the street and have no societal support. And it's not even like an ethical thing. Like homeless people are a drain on society as they exist. If they overdose, that's a drain on our medical system. If they live in like a northern climate, Pittsburgh, whatever, and it's the winter and they have pneumonia or frostbite or whatever. I don't know. I'm from Texas, so I don't know what happens when you get cold. It's a mystery. That's also a drain on the medical system. If they do a crime because they're so desperate and hungry and they have to go to prison, that's a drain on our prison system. So I think overall, you can even make an argument that just housing these people would be a cost-saving measure for society, for taxpayers overall. So that's sort of my position.
So, I mean, one of the kind of key things I want to zone in on, no pun intended, is... you know, you mentioned, you know, the crisis of homelessness, and something that they bring up very quickly in the section on at the outset is this idea of, you know, why do we have homelessness? Why does this happen? And you know, they kind of zone in on the fact that more often than not, it's a cost issue, you know, in terms of how much the homes cost. And you know, in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily agree that we have enough housing or an abundance of housing. At least in our metropolitan areas, there's not an abundance in the sense that we're able to address the massive demand of these areas. You look at states like California and New York that have been historically and notoriously bad at trying to address these issues with their zoning policies. I mean, you can drag in redlining if you really wanted to, but you know, there it kind of falls down on this issue of there's this strand of liberal policy which has attempted to restrict supply, and as a result has caused the crisis of homelessness, because all of these other things that we look at as a result, where you have the drug epidemic as a result, or turning to violence, these are symptoms of the problem, not necessarily the problem in of themselves. So, I mean, at least coming from my part of things, you know, you can address the cost issue at no cost by pulling back on a lot of these regulations that states like California and New York have been putting so much effort into holding up, and or at least have felt the pressure from the NIMBYs in their respective communities to uphold these regulations, which, quite frankly, it doesn't really cost anything materially outside of maybe the administrative cost of just kind of keeping the lights on while you're debating it. You know, for you to roll back these things, and you already experience so much change from there that, you know, it's an ambiguous amount of change. You know, how much are you going to make a dent in the homeless population? How much are housing prices going to fall down? But you could look at some pretty good case examples. You know, in your home state of Texas, I believe it was Austin that just recently saw rents tumble about 20% because the housing stock went up. You know, and that's it ultimately falls down to, you know, can you allow the market to address demand? I mean, if you're getting rid of these artificial caps, that should do enough in of itself. And then you kind of ask the question, well, is it necessary for us to start subsidizing demand again? On your front of things, it would appear that your position to an extent requires some amount of subsidizing demand, or you know, doing some sort of subsidy to allow for access to housing. So I'm curious if that, you know, how that would play out, and to what degree the government or state capacity to act would be necessary if you were able to pull back on just the caps on supply.
Yeah, so just to re-clarify my position, like, obviously right now, like, there is a lot of cities where the housing situation is so far not great, not conducive to, like, universal housing. You know, how do I put this? Like you were saying, like, rents are exorbitantly high in Los Angeles and New York. But I think my position is this is not like a human economic. Like, we have the labor capacity, we have the technology to build enough homes for everyone to live, just simply, just as simple as that. So then the question becomes, why don't we have that? And yeah, I think you adequately addressed some of these issues. A lot of it, well, all of it is just policy issues, basically. Some of it might be like cultural or whatever, but I feel like the vast majority is policy. These are policy decisions that are very deliberately put in place. A lot of it is like the YIMBY NIMBY debate. We know. I was going to bring up Austin myself because it's an example I'm well aware of. It's right in my neighborhood, so to speak. You know, Austin has grown so much. You can look at a skyline picture of, like, Austin in 2015 versus Austin today, and it's like, it looks like a different city. And this isn't like because nobody wants, like rents are also super low in Austin. And there's like two sides of that. There's supply and demand. And one might be tempted to say, well, nobody wants to live in Austin, but that's just not the case. You know, you ask anybody
in Dallas. Do you want to live in Austin?
I'd like to. Like, everyone wants to live in Austin. Austin's the cool place to live. It's like the LA of Texas. Like, people want to go there. So it's clearly not like a low demand thing. It's, they're doing something right. I think they've enacted good policies. Houston has done similar things. They have very, very notoriously soft zoning policies. So there's that, obviously. And yeah, I think you would have to have a very strong state capacity if you wanted to like provide a universal layer of guaranteed homelessness. But I think it is possible. I think a really good example of this is Japan. Japan is a country of how like almost a billion people, right?
A good amount.
I don't know.
Not off, yeah. I don't know off the top of my head, but yeah, you, so.
Maybe like, okay, 100 million. Okay, not nearly as much as I thought, but.
A lot of people. Well, the thing is, put it that way.
They have in their entire country about 2,000 homeless people. And this is like in Tokyo. Like if there was a city in the size, if there was a city the size of Tokyo in the US, there would be like a bajillion homeless people. So clearly like Japan is doing something right. And I think a big thing is that they have a pretty generous a welfare system there. That kind of just doesn't accept homelessness as this thing. And I think a lot of it in Japan is also a cultural thing. Like this culture of there's a very, very strong stigma around homelessness and also like around hospitality. But I think a lot of it is like statewide decisions on the part of a government to support like very strong housing policies, because Tokyo is another place that has notoriously very low rents for a city of its size.
Well, I think you can look
and
at
Tokyo also has very, very, you know, not great houses, but like these tiny, tiny little condos that people have.
Yeah, and that's
I think
kind of...
that's fine. That's great. That beats living on the street.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of things that I would want. I would want like not a great quality of housing. Because obviously like cost is a worry, but like anything's better than people living on the streets.
Yeah.
So if there's a way to do this with like it being entirely free market, I would like that. But so far I haven't seen a good case of this being done like entirely through market forces and market incentives. So just to go back to your question, yeah, I think you would have to have a pretty strong government program for this to work.
I guess the one thing, and I will kind of pivot from there, is, in the case of Japan, they have extreme, especially Tokyo, extreme density, which allows, uh-huh. You know, is a supply thing. They have enormous supply.
Sure.
I mean, maybe it's not the best supply. You mentioned that, you know, they're not the best apartments, but it's supply nevertheless, which allows, you know, rents to go down like that. But, you know, there's a lot to consider, I guess, very briefly, because I know there's a bigger topic we want to get to. While we're on the topic of other nations, you know, immigration never ceases to be a topic of interest. I know we have very many overlapping positions on this, but I guess the thing I wanted to probe you on a little bit was, as it relates to... The illegal nature of crossings, you know, be it for someone who's, you know, either of ill intent or not, I guess, you know, because we definitely agree, you know, there needs to be reform in the system as it relates to making it easier to immigrate. But as it relates to people who do come illegally, if you do go about treating it as a criminal offense, being that it you know it is a crossing that is not legal, so I'm curious to probe your thoughts on that, especially being from a border state. Kind of very briefly, what you think?
I have to organize my thoughts for a second. Sorry. I feel like when we call it like this illegal, like it moralizes it a lot that they've done some big crime. And I just don't see illegal things as necessarily morally bad things. You know, you can imagine a situation like a mother stealing food for her starving kids. I don't see that as morally bad. And a lot of the times, this illegal immigration is a similar thing. It's these people in very, very desperate situations, so desperate that, like, I can't even imagine having to make some of these decisions. I know in the case of a very famous case recently of I'm not sure exactly what his name is. I think it's Kilmar Abrego Garcia. It's
the Venezuelan gentleman.
El Salvadorian.
We're jumping between El Salvador and Venezuela so much right now in the news that get the streams crossed. But yes.
He was coming to the United States because a gang back in El Salvador was threatening the life of him and his family. And he came here and he worked in the United States. He has a pretty good paying job. He's contributing to the economy. He's paying taxes. He's buying local goods. He has a family. He has a wife who's an American citizen. He has kids here. And even though, yes, he came here illegally originally, I'm not comfortable saying he's any less American than you and me. And so it's sort of a case by case basis like that. If they're coming here to do terrible things, then obviously I'm not happy with that. If they're here to do crimes, if they're here to smuggle drugs, that's not great. But I don't think that's the vast majority of the people who are being deported right now. So I think you'd have to deal with that on a case by case basis, decide, is this person well integrated in the American society and the American economy? Are they contributing to our economy? And did they come here under a situation of distress? I think those are all considerations you have to make in these cases. And I think more often than not, I would like these people to stay here because it is a good thing for immigrants to be here, and it's very difficult for them to come here right now.
Yeah, and I think that's the crux of where we have a lot of our agreement. That, you know, I think we both agree it should be easier to come here. You know, I definitely hold the sentiment that it is a good thing to have immigrants in this country. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for the fact that my grandparents came here as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, I definitely have.
Neither of us are Native Americans, I don't think. Imagine. I don't think most of the people listening are 100% Native Americans, so we're all immigrants.
And I think, you know, kind of where the thing I wanted to kind of zero in on is, you know, you bring up the point of, say, you know, a mother who steals bread. You know, we show compassion in those cases where we review the violation of the law. I'm curious to what extent do we provide, say, slaps on the wrist, because I mean, you know, you're still talking about, irrespective of the fact that, you know, potentially there's a moral good or even maybe a moral ambiguity, you know, there is a law that's broken. I think that's, you know, the kind of the key core and principle thing here. To what extent do you exercise grace, and to what extent do you go about the upholding of the law? So I mean, you know, it's a lot to kind of touch on, but unfortunately we cap ourselves to 30 minutes here, and you know, restrain the you know, free flow of intellectual debate. But I know, you know, there was the one thing that you wanted to get to, and I definitely want to make sure we had some time to speak about it. You wanted to speak about gender. I would assume this is of a broad kind of heady general what do we think here, but I'm getting, is there something specifically that you wanted to touch on?
So this is for a class project of mine, obviously. So I wanted to get your opinion on this. So there's this sort of model of three different models of marriage. So there's this idea of a traditional marriage. This is what you imagine, like the housewife. You know, the wife typically doesn't work. If she does, it's like maybe a part-time job. She does the majority of of the housework, the majority of taking care of kids. And then there is this neo-traditional model. Let's hold that thought. Let's go to the opposite end. There's this progressive model where this is what like a very egalitarian person would advocate all marriage should look like. You know, equal, both the mother and the father are breadwinners. You know, they might have roughly equal incomes, and they split housework, they split caring for the kids equally amongst them. And then there's this neo-traditional model, which is a bit of a mix of the two, of this. Basically, the mother does work, but she also does the brunt of the housework, of the taking care of the kids. And I wonder, of those three models of marriage, which of those would sound the most appealing to you? Which of those you believe not our society should be structured on, but which do you believe you would want your ideal marriage to look like?
Oh, this is interesting. We're breaking from the politics here on the show, which is cool, I guess.
Let's say scaling it down to a microscopic level.
I guess we can say that. I mean, listen, I'm in many ways I'm an old school guy. You know, that's just the kind of world I grew up in. More often than not, the type of people of my background gravitate towards the neo-traditional in a lot of ways, because and I think this is also informed in a lot of ways by my faith. I definitely think, you know, as a Catholic, you know, there's this in conception of marriage, we define, you know, separate but equally important roles for both the man and the woman in the relationship. And I think, you know, this is kind of the thing that's lost on a lot of people when they look at the Catholic or, you know, even generally Christian conceptions of marriage between a man and a woman, because it's, you know, obviously there are certain things that both the man and the woman have going on for their respective roles in the marriage, but they are of equal importance, and there's equal accountability between both halves to hold up their end of the bargain. I don't think that the neo-traditional model really deviates much from that, from the traditional, in so much as it still maintains kind of the core essence of what's going on, with some, you know, realities that kind of reflect back on potentially some of the socioeconomic factors we have to kind of put into consideration for a lot of families that are currently trying to make ends meet and need to live on two incomes. I mean, I can tell you it's definitely not easy in New York to afford to live there, when the median households the median house price selling in my home county is almost $750,000. It's ludicrous. So, you know, I can say that I would kind of bounce between the two. But, you know, obviously as a libertarian, so long as you're not hurting other people, I'm very much of the opinion that you, you know, pursue the model that works for you. But I'm curious then, you know, is there any kind of further consideration from that you wanted to touch on? Or, where you personally kind of fall on that? Where does that kind of pan out for you?
So for me personally, obviously, I'm a very progressive person, so I think that's the type of model I would want. I would want sort of shared responsibility, both parents having relatively equal status, income levels. And this is sort of the environment I was raised in. My parents, sometimes some would lean a little bit more, but generally I feel like both my mom and my dad had a very big role in raising me. So I'm curious, you said that in your faith, both the men and the women have these separate but equally important roles. So I'm curious, what would you conceive as the role for the man in a marriage?
I mean, he's ultimately the primary provider, you know, and mm-hmm. this kind of falls back into, you know, sure, there can be, you know,
so like kind of this breadwinner role.
Yeah, and you know, at the same time, you know, it can't, the woman, you know, can, and if she has the desire to do so, should pursue a source of income as well. But the conception is, you know, that there's the primary role in the part of the man to do so, being kind of the ultimate defender of the family, things of that sort, which is mirrored in a lot of ways by the nature of both men and women in just kind of how the there's a kind of attitude of what manhood is and what womanhood is that's presented through the Bible, which mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it's kind of cut and dry this is the case. I mean, obviously we're not, from the perspective of faith, we're all made in God's image, but we have varieties upon which that is different. But there's kind of broad generalizations that encompass certain deviations as well that just are brought forth by the Bible. And I did actually do a very interesting Bible study a while back on what does the Bible say about manhood? What does it mean to be a man? What are the virtues inherent to masculinity? We're kind of in the last minute here. I mean, any kind of closing thoughts there that you wanted to bring in?
No, this has been really, really great. A good conversation, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if you feel the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's always so crazy how fast the time goes. It is.
Yeah, I was very surprised about that.
it makes you yearn for the days of ye old tavern. The coffee, well, whatever you wanted, the salon. So, but anyways, thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure to have you, and I hope you guys enjoyed having an actual guest on the show once again. But I'll send you all off with this. You all have a wonderful rest of your day. Take care, and God bless.
You are listening to a replay of October 31st, 2023 show of A Minute Pause with Sean Watson. That's me here on 88.3 FM.